Dozens of people gather while it is still dark. It is cool, so many people are rugged up. But as the light hits the horizon, music starts. First a trumpet, then a drum. Across multiple locations around the country, people march in military uniform. Old men with a chest full of medals. Women and men who currently serve in our army march. Strong and precise, there are images of past soldiers projected onto city walls that celebrate and give thanks for those who sacrificed their lives fighting for us. People lay down flowers, there's scattered red poppies across the ground, and people listen quietly, respectfully, as they remember those who sacrificed themselves. That was Anzac Day last year. It is a day that is considered sacred for many people. It is a day that is growing in popularity. It is a day that celebrates national deliverance. But it's not just Anzac Day. I mean, you can go down to Canberra at any point and visit the war memorial. The government is spending $500 million to upgrade the memorial. I think it's pretty beautiful already. You can enter the Hall of Memories, and it's like entering a cathedral or a temple. There's stained glass windows, mosaics, an acknowledgement for the unknown soldiers who died. And at the end of the day, every day, the last post-ceremony takes place. The national anthem is played. Someone plays a lament on the trumpet. And people tell stories and then lay down flowers. This, too, is growing in popularity. Now, if you've ever visited the War Memorial, or if you have ever participated in an Anzac Day parade, then this might help you understand Psalm 118. In ancient Israel, the people would line the city streets of Jerusalem, and the music would start. First the lyre, then the harps, then the trumpets. The priests would be standing at the temple in their flowing blue robes, and the king and his army would march towards them, and everyone would be singing these words, verse 1. Give thanks to Yahweh, for he is good. His love endures forever. Let Israel say, his love endures forever. Let the house of Aaron say, his love endures forever. Let those who fear Yahweh say, his love endures forever. This is a national song, an anthem which anyone could join in, whether you're a kid all the way up to the king. This is a chorus that people would sing year in and year out. This song grew in popularity, sung on public holidays and sacred days, whether it was the Feast of the Tabernacles or the Passover. People would actually sing starting from Psalm 113 and end with Psalm 118, a collection of songs that became known as this prayer called Hallel. And in these songs, they would praise Yahweh. And particularly in this song, why are they praising Yahweh? Because Yahweh has hesed, because Yahweh loves. That's what it's translated here. It's like this steadfast love. And who does Yahweh love? Yahweh loves Israel. And one of the ways that Yahweh shows that love is by delivering Israel time and time again. The voices fade and we have the voice of the king, or someone representing, playing the king, speaking, sharing his testimony. Verse 5. When oppressed, I cried to Yahweh. He brought me into a spacious place. Yahweh is with me. I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? Yahweh is with me. He is my helper. I look in triumph for my enemies. It's better to take refuge in Yahweh than to trust in humans. It is better to take refuge in Yahweh than to trust in princes. All the nations surround me, but in the name of Yahweh I cut them down. They surrounded me on every side, but in the name of Yahweh I cut them down. They swarmed around me like bees, but they were consumed as quickly as burning thorns. In the name of Yahweh I cut them down. I was pushed back and about to fall, but Yahweh helped me. Yahweh is my strength and my defense. He's become my salvation. We get a glimpse at Anzac Day and when we visit the war memorial, of the effects of war. But for most of us, war is a distant idea, something that we either know happened in the past or we know vaguely is happening in countries far away from us. This is pretty unusual. For most of history, war was this very real and constant threat for most people. And there was this longing for peace, longing for protection, and so people would regularly pray to the gods or to a god for protection. I mean, the gods are meant to be stronger than people, so surely the gods can save. And Israel is no different from other nations. I mean, how Israel was formed is particularly peculiar to Israel. They were a people group who were slaves in Egypt, and Yahweh heard their cries and delivered them. And that kind of forged them into a nation. They fought and settled in the land of Canaan, but they were never a particularly strong nation. They constantly had skirmishes with other small nations, fighting over boundary lines. And then mighty empires rose up and began to swallow those small nations left, right, and center. And Israel was afraid that they'd be killed off, or also afraid that they would be absorbed, that they would lose their identity. So they clung to God. And that is what this song is celebrating. Yes, they are weak, but they worship a God who is strong. And if God is on their side, they'll be okay because Yahweh is their helper. If God is on their side, they can have victory over their enemies because God is with them. And so in the name of Yahweh, they will cut them down. This is what salvation looks like. It looks like being delivered from oppressors and invaders. This song celebrates national deliverance and credits God with that success. Even if other nations or people groups disappear, somehow they survive. Now, we don't know that much about war. It's a distant idea, as I said. And I think we feel like we live in a strong nation, not a weak one. But every now and then we might get rattled. If a terrorist strikes, we're rattled. Or if it strikes, you know, close to home, New Zealand, we get rattled. Or if a house is broken into, we can get rattled. Or if money is stolen from our bank account, that can frighten us. But even then, we don't naturally turn to God. God seems kind of irrelevant. We turn to and trust in our strength. We trust in having a strong defense force. We trust in weapons and technology, cybersecurity. We trust in our government to save us. That's what our government promises. To have a strong economy, to have strong borders. We can put as many locks and cameras under our houses as we want. We can build up strong passwords to protect us when we shop online. We can have strong bodies, learn how to defend ourselves. So even though war seems like a distant idea, Australia still pays a lot of money for defence. This is not something we ever have to campaign our government to do. They will do it. And Australia actually ranked in 2017 number 12 in the world for the amount of money we spend on our military budget. The belief is the stronger you are, the stronger the alliances, the stronger weapons, you'll be safe. Everyone wants to be a strong nation or a friend to a strong nation. Across the world, $1.7 trillion is spent every year on defense. Because it will save you, right? If you get into trouble, your soldiers, your alliances, they will deliver you. The global arms business is a multi-billion-dollar business, and weapons have skyrocketed. In fact, there are more weapons being sold now than during the Cold War. It's reached a peak, and China and Russia are leading the way, and Australia thinks this is a great idea, and we want to get involved. Our aim is to be number 10 in the world when it comes to being an arms exporter. And across the world, we see strong, tough men being elected. They're looked at for many people as being saviors, going to deliver their nations. But is this the answer? Is this the best we can have? There are serious challenges facing us as a nation, alone in the wider world. There are alliances shifting. There's the threat of what's going to happen to all these weapons if they fall into the wrong hands. There are serious challenges ahead of us. Nick Warner, our spy chief, recently gave an interview and he said the security threats facing Australia are endless. Australia is facing some of the most challenging strategic circumstances that it has for decades. Psalm 118 is a countersong to the strong anthems that we hear, and it suggests that maybe we need to pray for our nation, not just ourselves as individuals. And maybe it's not wise to put all your hope in technology to save you. It's not wise to put all your hope in governments to save us. Don't put your hope in the princes of the world. Israel sang Psalm 118 quite a lot, just like we sing a lot of songs, but sometimes you can sing songs and they don't actually impact your life. Israel would sing these songs, but in the day to day, they kind of lived like us. They trusted in their rulers more than God. They trusted in the alliances they had made more than God. They trusted in the military. And then they were defeated. They were swallowed up by empire after empire until they were occupied by the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was strong. A big military budget, the latest weapons, disciplined soldiers. And they conquered people group after people group with a sword and maintained that peace by a sword. And you could be forgiven for wanting to stop singing songs like Psalm 118, which seemed kind of quaint, to talk about God delivering you. I mean, that was such a distant idea for the people of Israel. And yet, they kept singing these songs. They kept clinging on to God. Verse 15. Shouts of joy and victory resound in the tents of the righteous. Yahweh's right hand has done mighty things. Yahweh's right hand is lifted high. Yahweh's right hand has done mighty things. I will not die but live, and will proclaim what Yahweh has done. Yahweh has chastened me severely, but he has not given me over to death. Open for me the gates of the righteous. I'll enter and give thanks to Yahweh. This is the gate of Yahweh through which the righteous may enter. I'll give you thanks, for you answered me. You've become my salvation. The people kept singing this song on their holy days and festivals. God will bring victory. God's right hand will bring victory. In other words, that God will raise up someone who will bring victory, someone who will be given special honor, presumably a king. And this king will have victory and Yahweh's name will be exalted, and this king will enter the temple and give thanks to God. Open up your gates. God is going to act. This became the urgent prayer for people in the first century. This longing for drastic change. I don't think we have the same longing. If anything, we probably just hope and assume that life will always be the way that it is, that we'll always live this way. But Israel longed for salvation. They longed for drastic change. And so when Jesus begins his public ministry, this is the context into which he is entering. This desire is very real. People are looking for God to act, looking for the Messiah to come, raise up an army, overthrow the Romans. And some people think that maybe Jesus is this one. The crowds gather on the streets of Jerusalem. There's gentle pushing and shoving. There's people selling food, music playing, some trying to make their way to the temple. When news gets out, Jesus is entering the city and there's this excitement. First one person, then another begins to throw their cloaks onto the ground until there's this path being created. And here is Jesus riding through the city on a donkey. Now that's slightly jarring. It's not particularly good PR management. It would be better if he'd come on a strong, majestic war horse. But brushing aside that detail, maybe people brush that aside because they were just swept up in the excitement. Here Jesus comes. The one who's performed miraculous healings. The one who speaks about God's kingdom being near. People welcome him as king, and suddenly, I don't even know how, there's all these palm branches being distributed and people are waving them and singing to Jesus. And what are they singing? This psalm. Verse 26, they're singing, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of Yahweh." They look at Jesus and see one who comes in the name of Yahweh. They look at Jesus and see one who is God's right hand. The Messiah, He's going to fulfill all the words of Psalm 118, going to deliver them from the Romans. Shout with joy, because God is going to do mighty things through Jesus. He approaches the temple and enters. People are saying, yes, he will save us. This is the hope that is swirling around the crowd, which Psalm 118 beautifully captures. Verse 25. Yahweh save us. Yahweh grant us success. Blessed is he who comes in the name of Yahweh. From the house of Yahweh we bless you. Yahweh is God, and he has made his light shine on us. With boughs in hand, join in the festal procession up to the horns of the altar. In some ways, they've got it so right. Jesus is making a claim to the city. He's making a claim to be the rightful king from the line of David. And I think he's even hinting at his deeper identity, that this is God, the glory of God, coming back into the temple. And yes, Jesus wants to save them, just not in the way they imagined. Jesus isn't going to save them from Rome. This is not another national story. God has something bigger in mind. By the end of the week, the crowds will be disappointed in Jesus. He will have failed them. Maybe they'll even cry out for him to be put to death. By the end of the week, the religious leaders, also feeling like Jesus is going to try to overthrow the Romans, will hand him over to the Romans. Overthrowing Rome? That's impossible. Better to give him over now, this one weak-looking man. And Jesus will be crucified, and there'll be a sign above his head that says, King of the Jews, another veiled king, and those who have power and strength will exert their dominion once more. Between the Sunday and the crowds welcome Jesus as king, quoting Psalm 18, to a few days later when he's dead, between those few days, Jesus spends them teaching in the temple. And one of the last things he says is actually a quote from Psalm 118, but this is what he quotes, something different to what the crowd quoted. He quotes verse 22. The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Yahweh has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Yahweh has done it this very day. Let us rejoice today and be glad. According to this song, it's the weak and the unexpected that God chooses to work through. It's the weak king that the nations laugh at that brings God's victory. It's a miraculous subversion. And Jesus presses into this subversion saying, why is it that you religious leaders seem to consistently fail to notice where God is at work? You consistently crucify God's messiahs again and again. I mean, you would even kill his own beloved son. Why is it that you fail to see? But it is the stone that the builders reject that becomes the cornerstone. God works in unexpected ways. And deliverance does not actually come through strength and might. It comes through God. And God has hesed, faithful love, not just for Israel, but for all the crowds of people across the whole world. God loves, and that is what leads Jesus to the cross. This cross is a weird symbol that is projected all around us at Easter, which reminds us that God's desire is to deliver everyone, you and me, and deliver us not from another nation attacking us, but deliver us from all the things that separate us from God, our self-reliance, our tendency towards violence, our strength, our fixation on technology or quick solutions. Jesus rescues us from the things that lead to death, things that are evil, in an unexpected way, not by people fighting it out and sacrificing their lives, but by God becoming weak and laying down his life for us. Such salvation is so powerful. It's the most important thing we could celebrate, because this salvation changes people and can change whole societies and nations. We don't need to be obsessed with being strong. We can actually embrace being weak. We can actually choose to be weak and live a different way. Brian McLaren says that to follow Jesus is to see through every regime that promises peace through violence, peace through domination, peace through genocide, peace through exclusion and intimidation. Following Jesus instead means forming communities that seek peace through justice, generosity, and mutual concern. Our God rides on a donkey, and we are invited to fall in behind Jesus, to march behind Jesus and sing a counter song. That is why we as a church engage in national issues, engage in politics, and we engage in issues that are particularly concerned for the weakest people. That's why we call for an end to slavery or call for the foreign budget to be lifted, because we know that there's another way to live. And yet we do this knowing that we do not rely on the government to save us. We look to Jesus. And that informs our political decisions and it informs our small decisions to be vulnerable, to smile at a stranger, to talk to someone you don't know, to get to know your neighbour. It's why we as a church practice generosity, to let go of our strength and to give it away and to trust that there is enough. It's why we practice these hard, weak things like reconciliation and forgiveness and service. It's when we are weak, we see God's glory and majesty. This is the salvation of Jesus Christ. So this Easter, I want to invite you, wherever you are, to follow Jesus, to be set free to live another way, to join your voices, the chorus of voices, singing this song, verse 28, "You are my God and I'll praise you. You are my God and I'll exalt you. Give thanks to Yahweh, for he is good. His love endures forever."